Of course, welcome to tonight's class on the 6 through 10 of Cups. It has been an interesting week in the sense that nothing has happened on the outside and lots of stuff has happened on the inside for me. If I had my choice, hey, I'd go somewhere and pull the covers up over my head and sleep for a week and not come out again till the sun was shining somewhere. And I'm not able to do that. But anyway, so just with that little thing about how I feel, just mention that our last class, you may remember, was just the day after those bombings in New York and Washington. And tonight is actually, I believe, the beginning of the, is it the beginning? Yeah, the beginning of the second week after those events. And we, and I guess the whole world, have, as far as I can tell, begun to change in some way. And the change seems to be, I'm talking for myself here, and I don't know for sure if it's true for other people, but it seems to me that change happens or is happening on all sorts of levels, from the surface of things to the depths of things. But even though they're happening, and they're happening all over to everyone in one way or another, sometimes deeply and sometimes on the surface, the changes aren't easy. They aren't easy to see. They aren't easy to grasp. Even when you look at yourself and you ask yourself, you know, what those are, it's hard to find out, hard to get a handle on it. And my feeling, I've been asking myself a little bit about the relevance of tarot in all of this. I mean, when things are really tough, do you want to deal with, you know, symbols and intellectual things and spiritual things at a time when the body is threatened? And all sorts of stuff like that was going through my mind. And I ended up feeling about tarot that what happens with it is, what's useful, what relevance it has, is that it actually lets us see and grasp and contain in words and thoughts and actions the things that those things in the world and ourselves that are too big or too subtle or just too deep for ordinary responses. It's a language that actually is able to express things that ordinary chatter and the things off the top of our heads don't readily get at. So we're continuing our study tonight of the Suit of Cups, which of course is the suit of the heart. And we're continuing with the numbers 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 of that suit. And I'm going to give you some things to consider about the traditional meaning of those cards and some things to do with them at you know, various points this evening. And before we begin, though, to do that, I'd sort of like to find out, I don't know whether this is just me, whether you even care to talk about it. If you don't, just say so. But I'd sort of like to find out how everyone is feeling now and how our feelings have evolved over the past week. If you don't, I mean, I'll call on people in turn, so you don't, I don't have to worry about volunteering and stuff. I'll just ask you all, and then if you don't feel like talking, just say so. But, Debbie, how are you feeling at this point?
Well, actually, we were viewing the TV just a little bit ago, and then they were showing scenes again, and it's still the same feeling. And there's an overwhelming sense of sadness. I did some meditations and prayer work, what I could do from where I'm at, and fear. One morning before I left to go to work, there was a blip on TV that this place in Maryland, and I'm 65 miles from the Pentagon. This place in Maryland was selling gas masks. And I told my husband, I said, I think maybe I want to get a couple of gas masks. And he said, you're overreacting. And I thought, well, maybe I am, but I'd like to get a couple anyway.
Yeah, right.
But it is a sense of fear and a sense of loss, and I don't think I've ever felt this way in my life over anything happening in our country. I remember when Kennedy was shot, and I was a little kid, but I remember that happening and where I was. But this is, it's very scary.
Yeah, it is very scary. Shahrazad, how about you?
Well, I'm just very, very sad.
I've got a little bit of nervousness too. I work in a school, in a college,
yeah.
And we have a lot of international students there. And I think my biggest concern, after getting past what, you know, the reality of what happened, and I do know people and that sort of thing, so it's really a direct kind of thing. I know people who have lost from that. But my biggest concern is the hate factor. And we've had a few students who have gone back to their countries, and some of them have gone specifically because they've been harassed, not necessarily by other students, but from the Colorado community. And I just hope that things don't get misplaced. I think if I have any fear, my fear is that things will be misplaced and people will be hurt who shouldn't be, and that's already happened, and I don't want to see our country perpetuate that.
Yeah. Are you concerned that it will grow, or do you think they'll put a cap back on it and we'll get back to being politically correct pretty soon?
I don't think we will. I mean, I would like to think that, but I fear with the government that we have, and I'm actually surprised that they're being as cautious as they are. But
mm-hmm.
I think with the government we have and the knowing the mentality and that sort of thing, I'm just afraid that some things might happen and more innocent people are going to be lost because of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my fear, not for myself, but just for the whole global community.
How, if at all, have your feelings evolved over the past few days?
Well, I think when it first happened, I was really numb. We didn't close the university because we do have a lot of students from the East, and we have a lot of international students. So we have New Yorkers, and a lot of them are resident students. And we had just started our term. It was the second day of classes.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to stay open so that people would be available to students if they needed to talk or find someone. And basically all everybody did was just listen to radios and trying to hear what was going on. But I think the reality of it was so big.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like watching a Die Hard movie. It was
right.
Yeah, it was just hard to see it as reality because you've seen this stuff on film.
Mm-hmm.
But you haven't seen it that this is real. And I think it was hard to get our heads around that. And so there was a numbness. And then we do have friends in New York, and they were affected with a son and a sister, and they had called my husband at home, and he called me, and even with that, it was just this sadness and this numbness, like,
mm-hmm.
this can't be real, something's going to happen. Now I know it's real, and I think the numbness is going away, but I'm starting to get to the point of sadness and irritation.
Yeah. Yeah. Ruth Ann and I had one of our very infrequent angry moments today. It came out of nowhere for no particular reason, yeah. And we've been warned about that. People have told us that bursts of irritation and depression are part of a kind of post-traumatic syndrome kind of thing.
Well, it makes sense because I have my assistant who, you know, manages the registration area and all that. She came into my office last night and she was just crying.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the students who were going back to Saudi Arabia and here and there. And yeah, I was just like, I can't deal with this.
Yeah, right, right.
Go away.
Right.
I didn't say that, but I was feeling that.
Yeah, yeah. Martha, how are you doing where you are? You've been going through some irritation-producing stuff already. And has this added to it or changed it in any way? Has it gone away or exacerbated or what?
Well, I think as long as I watch TV, what's going on TV is enough to exacerbate anyone. I haven't watched TV for the past day and a half, and that's making me less anxious.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to be on TV, it's allowed, they basically put a lot of people, they even say it, that they're bloodthirsty individuals.
Yeah.
And they even say it.
Hmm.
And they just go off and on, you know, and it's basically that's that's the tone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then of course you think about, you know, there's more to come, there's more innocent lives to, you know, be killed, the long struggle, the backlash, everything else. So since I haven't watched TV for the past day and a half, then I've just been overwhelmed with work. And I was thinking when you started to ask for our, you know, for where we are at.
Yeah.
And I'm going like, okay, I'm going from one extreme to the other. Now I feel totally overwhelmed by work. There's no life anymore.
Uh-huh, yeah. Is it a good thing or a bad thing as far as you're concerned?
Well, it's almost like right now I think I rather prefer that, because if I, you know, place my head anywhere else, if I go anywhere else, that's the tone that's being...
Yeah.
That's how things are being discussed.
Yeah, yeah.
I just find it a little too... overwhelming.
Yeah, so work is kind of an escape a little bit, or at least a baffle to keep it away from you. Good, good. So you're lucky, actually, to have that to do. Kelly, how about you?
I've been writing extremes. It was really, really good to come home.
Yeah.
It was really, really frightening to fly. The strangest thing that maybe would explain the extremes is we had a fire. We've had walls, but they've been pretty temporary, and they finally started to rebuild. So I came home, and I had this house that I've lived in forever, and the guys came to fix it, which means tear out walls and stuff. And on the way home from work that night, I read this thing about how they're thinking it's going to take 2 years to clean up.
Right.
And they were talking about how much they're moving now and how much still needs to be moved, and it was 2 years. And that was the first numbers that made sense to me, because I know what a year is, and I know how things... It just made sense to me finally. It hit home, and I was real freaked out about that. And I got home, and I had no house. It was gone, and there's this bulldozer in front. And, I mean, there's still a living area, but it's cut in half, and there's this huge moat around the house, and you have to walk around the block to get in, and
wow.
I just flipped out.
I bet.
It wasn't because the getting the house fixed is a bad thing. It's just I saw what they can move in 8 hours.
Yeah.
And my poor husband, I just flipped on him.
Yeah.
And he was going, what the hell? And, you know, and then, like I say, I work with very young kids, and they're just a wreck. They're just going back and forth. And I got really mad that I had to tell people stop letting them watch TV. It was just,
that's right. Yeah, right.
But so that's my week in review. I've just been extreme, and like you said, I'm very concerned about it.
You know, just to give you another number to put things in perspective, according to what we've been told, they are removing rubble at the rate of about 15,000 tons a day, and it's going to take them years.
That's what
they
were
saying.
A year. Oh, well, we heard a year,
but
at that rate a year.
Yeah, 13,000 tons a day for a year.
And I did some quick math on that and came up with approximately 5 million tons of rubble.
And from what I understand, what I heard was they have to be really careful when they start getting closer to the ground and picking it up, because of the structure of it and, you know, the water coming in to where the walls are built by the water, that they have to be really careful, even though it was a well-built structure, that there's not major...
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. All of those things will, as we watch the events and the actual things going on, the facts in quotes, they will have effects on us. And what I'm interested here, I'm interested in the inner landscape more than the outer one with us, because that is mostly what tarot talks of. And to get to just to begin to do what we need to do tonight, that's all those facts, all they do are mirrors to bounce our feelings off of and to look back at ourselves with them. Peggy, how does all this seem to you? Where, I mean, I remember, I didn't get a chance to respond to the email that you sent. I was going to, but I thought maybe some of that would come out tonight. I know that feelings have been stirred up considerably, and of course we are talking about cups and stuff, and so that's appropriate, but where are those feelings in you now?
you know, I still find myself reacting very, you know, being very sad at random times. And angry, but angry basically, for instance, I was in a restaurant, and I heard the people saying, well, we should deport them. And I just said, oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
That's what terrorists are. You're basically the same feelings that engender the hate that caused the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very prevalent in my little community, and it's so depressing.
Hmm.
And frightening.
Yeah.
And as, you know, Sherazad basically spoke my feelings. Like, I don't trust the administration. I'm afraid of extremes.
Yeah.
And, but also, it's a lot of the things I can't really put a handle on. It's just all of a sudden these feelings cropping up right and left.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we will hopefully. I'm hoping that the value of what we do here will be to look at some of that stuff and actually put a name and get a handle on some of that. Marcy, how about you?
I'm not sure how I feel, but I do know that I am finding my own way, and I really have to thank you, Ruthann, and my wonderful colleagues here, because working with the cards, this has been my salvation and has continued to help me through these days. And it's my source and anchor. It's my faith. And also, I'm just so proud to be an American. My heart is just so expanding with love and to see what's going on after these walls have come tumbling down. How even my friend who called from New York said there's no more road rage there. I mean, you two can witness this far better than I. But she said nobody's yelling and nobody's honking and everybody's embracing. And watching the news, and of course I have to turn it off too, but to be able to see the camaraderie, I overflow with joy. And that's about it.
Well, that's pretty strong stuff, and be interesting to see. No, more than interesting, it'll be crucial to see whether that cohesiveness continues and when and where and if we break apart again into, you know, bickering little bits and pieces. But anyway, we'll see about that. Ruthann, how about you?
First of all, I just want to say that I'm, you know, just listening to you all has been a wonderful experience for me, and also just in terms of understanding the depth of cups, because, you know, like, it's one of those things where people just say, oh, cups, that's emotions, you know, and you just like flip it off, and what does that really mean? And like all the things that we're discussing, all these things are part of that, and it's huge. And for me personally, it's still been hard to comprehend everything. I spent the first 4 days pretty much being numb, not having feelings come to the surface. I guess it was like too much, sort of like if you hit your body really hard someplace and it takes 3 or 4 days for the bruise to show, because it just takes that amount of time for the blood to well up to the surface, and it was feeling like that. I told Walt early on that during that time, before I was able to do any crying, which I still haven't done a whole lot of, you know, I said, I'm watching my reactions. One thing I've noticed is that I am short-tempered. So to be aware of that, that's one way that things are expressing for me. I've also noticed things, emotions expressing through my body, little muscle spasms or tics or things like that. And that I attribute to this. Last night was the first time that I found out that I lost somebody that I knew, and I haven't really quite come to grasp with that. Somebody I haven't seen in a long time, so it's not as immediate. I'm still afraid to call one of our students who's a firefighter, because I kind of don't want to know. I mean, I do want to know, and I don't want to know at the same time. that he's okay, but I don't know. I'm not sure. And I don't know. I'm also concerned about what I see as a lot of potential divisiveness within the country. You know, people being on different sides of things, and just the way we always are. But I think that now it can be dangerous, and that concerns me a lot. So I'm kind of waiting and seeing. It back to waiting for the other shoe to drop again, because I don't know what's going to happen next. And we also have a lot of personal concerns around the Tarot Festival, and we just don't know what's going to happen with that, and that carries huge ramifications for me. So part of me wants to try to make contingency plans. Sometimes I just don't want to deal with it at all, and I just want to wait and see what happens. It's a lot of complex stuff going on all at the same time, having a lot of trouble concentrating and just really forcing myself to do that.
Yeah, well, that is part of what's happening for me. I don't want to do any work. I don't want to face anything. And I was telling Ruthanne earlier today, my spirit is okay, and my mind works fine, but my body and my heart are both heavy. They don't want to do anything. And my body feels weak and rubbery, and I have no spirit, you know, no energy, no heart, as they say, to do anything. So it's kind of a struggle, and I'm watching it, and I would have thought that I would have, normally speaking, things don't reach me like that. I don't have an opening to deep places in my heart. Usually it's been pretty shored up most of my life, and for some reason or other, this is really doing a bang-up job of getting at that space, and I don't know whether that's going to end up being a good thing or not, but it surely is there. So I watch it in a way dispassionately, and in another way I watch it with a little bit of fear. I don't know what. It feels like a genie has been let out of the bottle and will never be put back in. And I was thinking about what I was missing, what I was afraid of, where the fear came from, what the change was made of. And what I thought was that what the terrorists did in this event was to rob us of a sense of certainty about tomorrow. We've always lived in the sense that we always had tomorrow. No problem. Whatever we didn't do today, we could always do tomorrow. And there was a sense of immortality there, like little kids have, that they don't think anything can ever happen to them. And the feeling was that was the feeling I always had. I don't know if it was true for everybody, but I always had them. I mean, this country was pretty safe. I mean, I'd look at terrible things that happened to other people and feel, you know, sorry for them in a remote sort of way. I certainly had intellectual sympathy for them, but I never knew what that was like. And now all of a sudden, I don't know whether the ground I stand on will actually be in one piece on any given day. I don't know what they're going to do up there in Washington, what plans they have for us, and everything that I hold sacred and dear in this country, everything that I love about it, I don't know if it's going to be in place tomorrow afternoon. I have no certainty at all. I've been robbed of certainty. And it makes me feel like I'm standing on the deck of a ship that's tossing in the waves, and I do not have sea legs, and I'm feeling a little seasick. That's sort of the way I feel at the moment, and the way I've been feeling continuously, and I'm curious to see if it's going to change any. But anyway, so those are sad things, and that's sort of, I guess we just have to deal with that one way or another. And what I want to do tonight is to see if the symbols of the cards have anything at all to say about this stuff, directly or indirectly. Is there anything in there or not? Now, we're going to be working, you know, with some numbers and some names, which is mostly what Tarot is made of, numbers and names. We're working with five numbers, the 6 through 10, and we're working with the one name, which is the name of the cup, the 6 of cups, 7 of cups. That's all we're talking about, a number and a name. And last week we talked a little bit about the numerology of Tarot. And I want to go over that very briefly, not the specifics of the numbers 1 through 5, but just the sense of how the numbers are divided, how the 10 numbers of the suits are divided up into categories. And as general categories, they make sense and they explain certain things. I think it was Scheherazade who mentioned that the initial shock of the events we're talking about was too big to get our hands, too big to get our minds around. It was numbing. It was too much. And in that, you find the ace and the two. In the ace, things just pour into the world like a flood through a dike, just as though something had opened up and an enormous flood of material has come pouring into our perceptions. And in the two, there's an explosion. An explosion beyond the ability of the mind to grasp. And in the three, there is the ability of the mind to grasp. The three is the attempt to understand, to contain the force of something that was too big for us initially. The one, the two, and the three, the ace, two, and three of any suit, are those abstract moments of the pouring of energy, the explosion of any kind of event, and the containment of that event in some kind of container, in some kind of grasp, and some kind of, I don't know, idea. Getting your hands around something is the essence of the three. The four, five, and six, the four, five, and six are the place of the soul.
The
place of the soul.
Okay.
It's the place where all the abstractness of that first rush of experience goes deep into the heart and finds a place there. And that's why I was asking you now how you were feeling now and how this week has been treating you as far as feelings are concerned and how your feelings have evolved, because the initial rush of events has been to some extent handled by that quality of ourselves that gets its hands around things and figures them out. But then it goes deeper and it goes into this place in the center of things, which we call the heart. And that's the place of the four, five, and six, the very center of the numbering system. I'm not going to go into the specifics now of what the numbers are about, just that section is that place that we call the soul. And it's odd that you can feel things and see things and know things and act from that place of the soul. Usually we act from the place of the mind, the heart, the body, and the spirit, which is the four elements that we're familiar with. And those four elements in their natural form are found in the 7, 8, 9, and 10. That's the third division of the numbers. The 7, 8, 9, and 10 are the world of nature. They're the world that we normally find ourselves in, the world of the personality, the world of the four elements, the world where everything shows, finally, shows its face and shows its form and does what it's supposed to do in the way that we're normally used to having them happen. And by the time all of that initial energy has passed through the first two stages of the 1 through 3 and then the 4 through 6, and then we enter into the world of nature, into the world that we can grasp, all of a sudden we get the specifics of things. In this case, we talk about what we're going to do, how we're going to handle these bastards that have been hurting us. When we get into specific political programs and economic things and how we're going to do the cleanup and all that, after the numbness and the shock and the energy and the love and the hate and the fear have all happened to us, we get down to the specifics. What are we going to do now? And the 7, 8, 9, and 10 are that area of specificity. That's the place where we live. Literally, that's where we live. If you take those numbers and that basic division and look at the four worlds that they come to us in the form of the four suits, and you look at the specific one we're talking about now, which is cups, and you remember that the suit of the cup, among other things, the symbol of the cup has in it three facets that I want to continue to kind of focus on. One is the idea of the sacred. The cup produces the circle of community, which produces the sense of sacredness, the idea of the chalice, the sacrament. The idea of the peace pipe, the idea of the bowl, and the pledging of troth in cups, the pledging of sanctity, the pledging of loyalty, the joining together in community. Those two things, sacredness and community, are big aspects of the cup. perhaps the biggest ones that have anything to do with what we're talking about now. And the third thing in the function of the cup and the aspect of the cup that I want to keep an eye on is the word heart, used in the form of the center of things, the heart of the matter, the heart of a thing, the core, the center, the main issue, the essence. From that point of view, the cup takes us right to the center, right to the pulsing heart of whatever's going on. I'm going to ask you to bear those things in mind when I talk about the numbers 6 through 10. Because the six is part of the triad of the soul. The six is part of the three numbers that form in our little group of 10, form the area of the soul. And from the position of the six, which, by the way, is named beauty, from the position of beauty, from the position of the sun, which is the planet associated with the number six, everything is good. No matter what happens on the storm-tossed earth below, from the point of view of the sun, from the point of view of the soul, from the point of view of beauty, it's all fine. The world never ceases to be magnificent from that place, no matter what happens. Then the seven. The seven is on that portion of the numbering system which is expansive, explosive, hot, fiery, intense. It's that part that's very much like the two. It's in the world of nature, in the place where things actually take their final shape. The seven is the number of the passions and the instincts, the appetites, the will to live, the desire for sex, the appetite for food, the fear and flight, the fight and flight mechanism. Everything that happens in the viscera, all of visceral reactions, the gut reaction, the hot breath of all the passions can be found in the number seven. And then we go to the number eight. Now the interesting thing about the number seven and all of its passions is that by itself, it is uncontainable. It's an explosion also. It's a fiery furnace. It's like a nuclear reaction without a nuclear plant to contain it. But the eight is the nuclear plant. The eight is the factory. The eight is the container of the mind. The eight is the intellect. And the intellect throws a net, a wall, a floor around, underneath, above and below all of the activities of the seven. All the explosive power of the seven is contained, understood, handled, made tame by the actions of the intellect in the number eight. And so all that force becomes useful. It becomes malleable. It becomes a tool. Through the function of the number eight, we get to the number nine. Oh, by the way, eight, the planet associated with the number eight is Mercury, the artist, the one who directs by the force of will, the one who knows, the one who understands, the tricky one, the one who gets a handle on things, the one who makes things happen. Mercury connects, communicates, understands. And then we get to the number nine, which has as its planet the moon. And the number nine is actually the ruler of the five numbers we're talking about. This is the lunar world we're talking about here, everything that happens under the moon. It's the place where the god and the goddess join to produce the entire world of nature that we know and that we are ourselves are expressions of. All the forms of male and female that we normally see in the universe can be found as a result of the mechanism, the mating mechanism of the number nine. Number nine is intensely sexual. And in the number nine, you have all the mechanisms by which reality finally comes to pass. everything, all the powers and forces and meanings of all the nine numbers before it are joined in mechanisms that work, in workable forms. They actually, all of the opposites of force and form are finally combined and produce a working universe in the number nine. And from the number nine and all of its workings and the clanking of the machinery of creation, finally comes the final product of the number 10, the final reality, the undeniable, solid nature of things. Very stable, very durable. And in the suit of cups, what could be the solid state, the durable final product of all of that work, of all of those numbers, through all of those processes? What does the heart finally come to? We'll have to look at that and see. But those are the five numbers at the end of the spectrum. So then the question would become, what happens when you join the qualities of the cup to the qualities of the number? What happens when name and number come together? When they mate and produce some kind of sense to them? When the six joins with the suit of cups? When that central goodness connects with perhaps the aspect of the sacred? When the fire of the number seven is combined with a sense of community? When the intellect gets its hands around the neck, so to speak, of the power of the seven, and we're talking about cups, then the issue of centrality, of the central issues, the main point, becomes the essence of the number eight. The eight of cups becomes the core issue that we deal with. The number nine in the suit of cups becomes all the forms of laughter and tears, all the ways in which the world is filled with joy and sorrow, all the ways in which everything that happens to us results in our feelings. The whole of the feeling universe is produced in the number nine. All the goodness of the heart is seen there as a working form. And then in the number 10, once again, you come back to the sacred, the communal, and the central. And all those things together are wrapped in the number 10. The 10 of cups produces everything. In the 10 of cups, the entire world, the entire beautiful, magnificent, lovable, sorrowful, sad, painful, exquisite, excruciating world is there in our fingers. We can actually feel it. We can see it, taste it, experience it with all our senses and all our understanding. And the sense of the world as being a veil of tears, which for many people it is, or a place of the most exquisite joy, which it is for most of us at least once or twice in our lives, that's the Ten of Cups. It's just the exquisite distillation of the entire process of the universe of cups comes to us at those moments when we experience the world that way. These are kind of brief ideas. They're not the whole thing. And you're probably aware that by this time we've studied enough together and you've done enough on your own to know that there's a lot of other things in the symbols than what I talked about. There's a lot of other aspects to the symbols of the cards. I mean, to when you look at the pictures on the cards, you may not even see the things that I'm talking about, because the pictures usually talk on another level. They talk about astrology, they talk about alchemy, they talk about, masonry, they talk about Rosicrucianism, esoteric Christianity, they talk about all sorts of things. And the pictures are made up of those things, and common divinatory things, and everyday common sense things, and I don't know, it just goes on and on. The pictures are pictures of layer after layer of meaning, and we are not talking about those things tonight. Just the ones that I talked about now, just number and name. Does any does this raise either questions or do you recognize any of the things that I'm saying, or does it sound somewhat foreign and abstract to you? I don't know how it feels to you. To me, it feels very real, but to you, it may not. Anybody care to volunteer a feeling on that?
For me, it was very valuable information because it gave me another perception as far as the numbers.
As far as I can tell, that combination of name and number is the first level and the deepest level of each of the cards. You could take those meanings, even if you took an index card that had nothing on it and wrote at the bottom something like Seven of Cups. That alone would tell you all the things that I'm telling you now. You wouldn't need a picture for that. The picture comes later.
If you took
an index card, just a plain 3x5 index card,
uh-huh,
and at the bottom of the card you wrote Seven of Cups, no picture, what I just said now would apply to that blank card just as well as it applies to a tarot card with full of pictures. It doesn't need a picture to express what I just said. Just the name and the number alone contain that. So what I'm telling you is before the pictures. A lot of people do not realize that the pictures are a late development in tarot. The organization, the system on which tarot was built, the skeleton on which tarot was built, is name and number. And they do not have pictures. So what we're talking about here is applicable, I think, to any situation you could find yourself in. When you're talking, say, about the Seven of Cups, you could find the power of the id, that is the libido. You could find the power of survival, the will to survive, the power of the appetites, and the power of fear and delight in just about everything or anything that you put your finger to. Anything that you perceived, anything that you lived through, anything that you experienced would contain that to some extent. In fact, that furnace of instinct and desire is the only thing that keeps you alive. It's what makes you warm. It's the fire of life in your chest. If you didn't have that Seven of Cups, never mind Seven of Cups, if you didn't have the Seven, forget, because there are four forms of the Seven, but if you didn't have the Seven, just the number Seven, and all the things that I just talked about in you, you would not have the ability to open your eyelids in the morning. You would have no reason to get out of bed. In fact, there would be no reason for you to exist at all. And that's just the number Seven. But you could do nothing with that power of will to live were there not some way of grasping it and putting it to use, which you find in the number Eight. If you didn't have a mind, if there were no form, if there were no container for that enormous hothouse of energy, it would explode into nothing. It would just go into space and just evaporate. Only the container of the Eight makes it possible for all of that power to continue to exist. It doesn't go away if it's in the container. And this, by the way, is one of the things that's true of the cup. The cup is also a container, the primary container. Among the suits, it is the container. And without the number Nine, neither the force nor the form would have any practical effect whatsoever. Nothing would actually happen. It would remain abstract. As powerful and as real and as natural as those things are, unless there were some set of natural laws to make something fall when you throw it up in the air, to make water flow downwards and to make sure that pigs don't fly, to make sure that corn grows out of the ground and not out of the water, you know, to make sure that fish swim in water and don't fly through the air, to make sure that all the things that we know in nature actually work according to law and mechanism that are dependable and usable, that is the function of the number Nine. Or at least one of the functions. And finally, what would be the use of all of that if there were no number 10? If the number 10 did not solidify all of that activity and produce for us finally a product we could get our hands on, some way we could actually live and experience this whole thing, what would be the point of all that prior activity? There has to be a reality at the end of it. Everything we've talked about up to now have been forces and containers and various ways of modifying them and putting them to use. But until there is actually a final product, there isn't any point. It's all just a game. But once the 10 comes into existence, you have consequence. You have a field of activity. And in that field of activity, all of the consequences of your actions, thoughts, and words take place. It's like a clay tablet, one of those wet clay tablets they used to use for cuneiform writing, where you take a stylus and you draw in the wet clay, and the clay hardens, and you have a record of what passed over the surface of it in the first forms of writing. This world is just like that. The number 10 is the place where the consequences of everything can be found, where the record of the consequences of every thought and deed and word are located, and where you experience the fruits of your actions. This is the world of karma, the number 10. When you look at the number 10, any card, any one of the four suits, you're looking at the place where all the consequences of your life are written. Talk about the book of life. That's it, the number 10. So that's where we stand with those numbers. Then you add to it the qualities of the suit, the qualities of the four elements, and you find the specific aspects of those numbers, because those numbers have four faces to them. And the one we're talking about tonight is cups. And so the three parts of cups that I want you to pay attention to concerning all the things we've been dealing with lately have to do with the sacred, the communal, and the central. Those three things. There are others, but those three things are they make sense in the context of what we've been going through. What I would like you to do now, before I go any further, I only got a chance to hear from a couple of you, you know, whether makes any whether this is clear or not. Martha, does this make any sense to you at all?
It does.
I mean, if you take a look at the cards, can you get a sense that that's what you're manipulating, that you're manipulating forces as primal as that?
No. I mean, I have not even seen the cards. I've been listening very closely to what you're saying.
Okay, then forget the cards. That's because we're not even going to worry about them for the moment.
But I did glance at the cards, and I said, Jesus, I don't see
yeah.
that.
Yeah, right, you don't see them, because the pictures, in an odd sort of way, what the pictures do is cover all that up. That's true. It's really funny. It's just like you take something and just throw it over the surface, like taking a cloth and throwing it over the table so as to hide whatever's underneath so nobody can see what you had there.
No, I kind of felt like I wish I could see it.
Right, it's hard to peel the cover off. It's hard to peel the pictures off. The pictures are so compelling that you actually can't see what's going on underneath because of them. Peggy, what's your feeling about all this?
Well, actually, as you were talking, I was trying to compare the joy of the cups in some of the cards
mm-hmm.
with the sorrow of the swords.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to see how the different levels, why the fruition, perhaps, of the swords and thought was not as joyful as cups. I was just trying to compare the different suits.
Yeah, but that's because you're have no choice but to get mired down in the picture.
And that's true.
And you know what that picture is? A picture is a picture of the end of something. It is the absolute end, that Ten of Swords. You're dead. Dead in this sense is the finish. Death is the closed door. Absolute assassination. Ta-da! Over. It is the function of the sword and the function of the mind to cut things sharply at the corners, to let you know when a thing begins and when a thing ends. That's the function of the sword, to give boundary and definition. And the picture that you're seeing in the Ten of Swords is a relatively crude but effective description or depiction of the absolute end. So if you take it from that point of view, it ceases to be something quite so emotion-laden. It is simply a picture of conclusion, but absolute conclusion. Without any hesitation, without any question, you look at that and you know in your gut, it's done. There's no coming back from this one. So from a certain point of view, it's a very clear picture of exactly what Swords is about, and it's not particularly sorrowful. Would you not like to know when, let's say, for example, is there a table nearby?
Mm-hmm.
Would you not like to know when the table starts and when it stops so that you don't drop something on the floor?
Yes.
I mean, when you put something on the table, you want to know precisely where it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you go downtown, you want to know exactly where you have to get off the highway to get there. You don't want to go one exit too far or one exit too near, and you want it to be exactly the same distance every day. You don't want it shifting around. You don't want it playing games with you. You don't want it longer some days and shorter other days. You want to be able to depend on the fact that a mile is always 5,280 feet. It doesn't shift on you. So you need to know exactly when a mile begins and exactly when a mile ends. And by God, when a mile is over, it's over. It can't. You can't play with it. And the Ten of Swords gives you that. That's a picture of what you're seeing. Only, of course, it's done in such a way as to provide fertile ground for fortune tellers. Anyway, that's a whole other subject. We're talking about swords there and not cups. But if I understand correctly, then the things that I've said at least have made some inroad. They've given you something to think about, no?
Mm-hmm.
Kelly, am I right about that for you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Debbie, does anybody have any objection to what I said? Is there anything about what I said that sounds as though, well, I don't know about that.
Dean, I like it, and I think the reason why I can connect to it, though, is because we did that, the class on the Tree of Life Made Simple and Easy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I can connect to it.
Right, of course, because this comes straight out of Kabbalistic thinking. It is exactly that, only I didn't refer to Kabbalah here. I just gave it to you in words.
Yeah, but I could make that relationship
right.
Through that.
Okay, good. That's
helpful. And a lot of things now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Funny how that works, isn't it?
Well, that was something that I found out a long time ago. One of my teachers told me that at the very beginning when I was learning this stuff, that Kabbalah was the best coat hanger in the world. I mean, the best, you know, closet and filing system that ever was. You can hang anything on it, put anything in its drawers, and find anything you want in the system somewhere. It's a perfect organizer. But anyway, that's very true. So,
except it has a bazillion drawers.
Well, actually, no. You know, it doesn't. It only has a relatively few drawers, but you can put anything in it and find it when you want it. I don't know exactly. Actually, that we shouldn't get off into that. That's a whole other story. But anyway, what I want you to do now, I'm going to give you a form of Kabbalah without mentioning it at all. And see if you can find it, and those of you who have some background in it. I don't know if every one of you does. I don't remember anymore who did it and who didn't, and I don't know
when did you do it?
When did we do it?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I don't know, sometime in the summer, I think, or the spring. I can't remember when we did it exactly, May, June, something like that, I think.
Oh, I joined in July, okay.
Yeah, so anyway, we'll do it again. But in the meantime, what I want to do is I want to give you the opportunity to do a reading for yourself. Now, everybody knows that doing readings for oneself can be trying. It can be difficult because being objective is hard. Here, we're not going to be talking about being objective. We're going to be talking about being subjective. When you read for yourself, you're being subjective. And that's perfectly fine. Nevertheless, there are limitations and boundaries and rules and stuff that will allow you to do that and be comfortable with the results. And I'm going to give you a spread for examining yourself at any given moment. And you'll find it, I think, very useful. And it is a spread that is called the chalice. And the chalice can be used for a number of things. I'm going to give you its use for this purpose, for examining yourself, your own feelings and stuff. Now, there is something interesting that I want to mention to you. I don't know if I mentioned it last week or not, but from my point of view, tarot has three major functions. One is to allow you to understand whatever it is that you're talking about. Whatever question comes up, it allows you to understand it, to get a handle on it, to grasp it. Two is it allows you either to predict or to scry. And to, by scrying, what I mean is to literally look into the future. Not to predict the future, but to look into it and to be there. And those of you who have done some past life work with us know one of the ways in which the cards can be used to do that. And the third thing that that tarot is useful for is to produce action, to tell you what to do next, to give you a foundation from which you can jump, a springboard from which you can jump into action. And a lot of people don't know that. They don't realize that tarot can be very proactive, but it can be. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a spread that allows you to do all of those things and some additional things besides in a very simple way. And it's a five-card spread, very appropriate for the five cards that we have in front of us. What I would like you to do, do all of you have the five cards out?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody not? If you don't, do it now. But what I would like you to do is to take the five cards and turn them face down. Just make a little stack of them face down. Don't worry about the order, because all I want you to do is to know the positions of the spread right now, and then we'll worry about putting the cards in the positions later. So taking card number one and putting it in position number one, just put a card face down in front of you, towards the middle of the table. Okay, just face down in front of you, vertically in front of you. And then take the second card. We're going to put down position number two. It's going to be to the left of card number one, with a space between them of about one card's width. So in other words, you have the two cards sort of next to each other in a horizontal row, with a space between them of about one card in width. Now I want you to take card number three and place it below the first two, right between them. And in the space that I mentioned to you, the empty space, right below those two cards, with the left corner of the third card touching the lower right-hand corner of card number two, and the upper right corner of card number three touching the lower left corner of card number one. So you have a little upside-down pyramid. Does everybody have that?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody not understand what I'm talking about? Okay. Now you're going to take card number four, and you're going to lay it horizontally right underneath card number three, so as though card number three was standing on it. And you'll notice that now the four cards that you laid out have a shape reminiscent of a cup. There is the container of the cup itself, the empty space between the first two cards and the bottom card producing a bowl, the third card producing the handle or stem, and the fourth card producing the base of the cup. Is there anybody who doesn't have that? Okay. Now we come to the fifth card. And the fifth card is going to be placed above the first two, diagonally, going from right to left downwards. And in other words, you're going to place the fifth card above the chalice, sort of as though it were diagonally going into the open space in the chalice, like as though it were a swizzle stick going into a goblet.
The top of the card is tilting toward the right or toward the left?
The top of
the
top of the card is leaning towards the right, towards card number one. And the bottom of the card is kind of aiming at card number two. And the corner of the card is sort of into the cup a little bit. So you've got a diagonal card slicing into the opening of the cup. And that's the entire spread. Now I'm going to tell you what the positions mean, what they're used for. And then later we'll fill the positions in. Position number one on the upper right is what you're feeling now. Position number two, the card on the left, is what you're thinking now. position number three, directly below those two, is what will I do and when and how will I do it? And position four, that horizontal card beneath the chalice, that is, what in me remains the same, remains unchanged. And position five, which is the diagonal card at the top of the figure, is how will I change?
Appropriate for a swizzle stick.
Yes, very appropriate for a swizzle stick. It's going to mix things up in there. It's going to stir things up. Okay. Now, having those five figures, if you write them down on a piece of paper so you know where, you can reproduce this figure easily once you take these cards off the table, do that, and then I'll tell you what to do next.